KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Dr. Deborah Peel of PatientsPrivacyRights.org. Deborah was referred to me by a former and repeat guest, Frank Pasquale, professor at Seton Hall, as someone who, as Frank described it, is one of the leading thinkers and advocates in this field. And I'm very excited to have Deborah on because I have wanted for quite a while to talk about, in particular, the technological issues and the broader privacy issues surrounding healthcare information, an issue of increasing importance as medical records and all of our medical records are moved from paper formats to digital formats. And in looking for someone who would be the ideal guest to discuss that issue, Frank was generous enough to mention Deborah to me, and I'm very excited to have Deborah on. We're going to be focusing today broadly on the issue of consumer or patient rights as it relates to medical information. This is an issue that is increasingly important, not only because records themselves are being moved to digital formats, but also because the law and policy surrounding it is being written right now. And the medical profession is adjusting to these technologies as well as policymakers, and so we have this fluid transition. At the same time, we're dealing with an issue which affects everyone, because every individual, from the healthiest to the least healthy, is going to be dealing with doctors and having medical records, and the question of what rights you have as a patient to use that to protect that information, and what rights the medical profession has to use it, is an issue of continual debate, and one becomes increasingly prominent, increasingly pitched. And so in PatientPrivacyRights.org, Deborah has an organization that advocates on the side of consumers on this issue. And so we're going to be discussing the issue certainly from the consumer's perspective today. And hopefully down the road I'll be able to have someone on to discuss it from the perspective of the medical profession, although frankly I think that Deborah is well-versed on both positions, and I think based upon my review of her work and the work of PatientPrivacyRights.org, takes a balanced approach to these issues, recognizing that there might be positive and good uses of this information, but at the same time wanting to push in the direction towards making sure that the public has, as Deborah and her organization have written about in a position paper on their website, have informed consent, that the ability of consumers to consent to that use in a way that is knowledgeable is maintained. And that's an issue that comes right out of contract law. It's something that I teach to 1Ls, although I'm actually not teaching contracts 1 this semester. I'll be teaching a course in trade secrecy. But one of the key questions that you immediately confront in contract law is the question of consent, or in contract law we'd call it acceptance, and whether that acceptance is knowledgeable. And we have a significant problem online, a crisis in contract, where it is unclear that entities, or in particularly individuals who are entering into online contracts, actually know to what they're agreeing. And that issue becomes particularly important in the context of, again, medical information, because oftentimes you will agree, whether you realize it or not, to certain uses of your information that you may not want, and much more problematically, and something we're going to talk about today, you may not even be asked for your consent, and information may be used anyway. So we have a lot of ground to cover here today with Deborah. Deborah, again, is a practicing physician, and she became active in privacy rights quite a while ago, and we're going to talk about that. She's been a plaintiff in cases involving issues of medical information privacy and security, including the case of Citizens for Health v. Levitt. She founded Patient Privacy Rights in 2004, and in 2010, Patient Privacy Rights and the LBJ School of Public Affairs partnered to convene the first ever international summit on the future of health privacy in Washington. She has been listed in Modern Healthcare's list of the top 100 influential people in healthcare at the modest number of 4 in 2007. And she's been listed for the last 5 years, and she is joining us from her home via Skype in Austin, Texas. Deborah, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, you're welcome. I am really happy to have this chance to talk with you.
And I appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time. Let me dig in a little bit immediately with a question I ask most of the guests I have on. I've mentioned a little bit of your background. Perhaps you could talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in patient privacy issues.
Sure. Well, I'm a boarded adult psychiatrist. I'm also a graduate of the Dallas Psychoanalytic Institute, and so I'm, in addition, a Freudian psychoanalyst. So I have worked for over 35 years in the most privacy-sensitive specialty in medicine, and the one that requires the greatest cooperation and collaboration in order to be of help to patients. So my interest in privacy and learning about privacy started literally when I first hung out my shingle in, 1979. And opened a solo practice. And literally the very first week that I was in practice, people came in to me and they said, if I pay you cash, will you keep my records private? Hmm. That was my beginning. That was my beginning to learn about privacy. There was no training about privacy, of course, in medical school. Or really significantly in residency either. And so, so I said, yes, of course. If you pay me privately, I'll keep your records private. Absolutely. So then that leads to the question of why did they ask that? And the reason was that's when I began to learn how much information leaked. And that was in the paper world. Mm-hmm. Late 70s was in the paper world. And so, for the last 35 years, I've heard nothing but complaints from people ever since about how their medical records got into the hands of employers and either caused job loss or reputation loss. So, information that was supposed to stay strictly between patients and doctors and insurers didn't, and I learned that in the paper world. And you don't have to be a genius to understand what's happened in the electronic world. At least in the paper world, records existed in a small number of places. You know, you went to 3 or 4 doctors, you went to a hospital from time to time. You might have physical paper records in 5 places. Now, with electronic systems, it's not even possible. It's not even possible to understand or know all of the places the pieces of your health information exist. It's not even possible.
And that, that leads to, I think, to telling us a bit about the founding of patient privacy rights. What is the reason for being for patient okay. privacy rights? And tell us a little bit more about it for those that aren't familiar.
Okay, well, this is kind of a funny story. So I think I mentioned I'm a Freudian psychoanalyst. So I don't know. I guess it was in the 90s, I think. Yeah, in the 90s. Okay. We, the Freudian analysts, and there's only 3,000 of us, okay, not exactly a large group of health professionals,
right.
But, typically a fairly serious and influential group nonetheless. And so we got very interested in what was happening at the federal level because of the Clinton Healthcare Initiative. And I don't think your listeners will know about this part of it, but one part of the Clinton Healthcare Initiative was the proposal that every doctor-patient visit would be recorded in a federal database. In other words, you know, every visit would be tracked. And as psychoanalysts, we're very, very concerned about privacy. And I started to talk about that a little bit, but you can imagine who's going to tell me as a psychiatrist or a psychoanalyst, anything if they think it's going to be on the internet.
Right.
Nope. right? Okay. So we got very concerned with that provision in the Clinton Healthcare Initiative, and we started to work together to lobby for something that was known as the right to private contracting. The logic being, if you pay for something yourself out of pocket, why should that treatment record go into a federal database? And, you know, clearly the Freudian analyst did not bring down the Clinton Healthcare Initiative. But that experience really caused us to focus on what was going on in Washington. And we saw over the years that followed all kinds of proposed legislation that would have done similar things, that would have in some way or another taken away the privacy of health information. So we were very aware during the Clinton administration of the proposed HIPAA privacy rule. We started we were very involved in that, and in fact, the single privacy protection that got into the HIPAA privacy rule that Clinton proposed and Bush implemented was for psychotherapy notes. So that's the, according to the initial HIPAA privacy rule, the only information that required patient consent before it was shared were psychotherapy notes. Anyway, so after Bush implemented the HIPAA privacy rule, for about a year, at the federal level, for the very first time, Americans had a vested right of consent. In other words, when the rule was implemented, consent was required to use and disclose your individual health information for treatment purposes, payment purposes, or healthcare operations. But about a year after the Bush administration got going, they reopened the privacy rule with the intent actually of changing and eliminating consent. And that's what happened in 2002. The consent provisions were replaced with regulatory permission. That's the phrase. Lawyers will like it. Regulatory permission to use and disclose your protected health information for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. Well, apparently, the Freudian analysts were the only people who noticed that change. Congress didn't notice the change. The media didn't notice the change. It was a sea change.
Yeah.
A sea change. And anyway, I eventually founded Patient Privacy Rights, and are still our main and most important educational document explains how we went from having federal rights to consent to the disclosure of electronic health information to no rights to control electronic health information because of that change. So anyway, so again, you know, back to the tiny analytic organization, we decided the only thing we could do, because no one noticed that our rights to consent had been eliminated at the federal level, was to sue HHS, sue the federal government. And so we did, and I was a plaintiff in that lawsuit, and actually my affidavits are what gave us standing in federal court. I don't know how interesting this is to your audience, but it kind of went like this. I went to several different pharmacies in Austin, Texas, where I live, and I requested that my and my family's prescription records not be disclosed without our consent, without my consent. So after weeks and months, I received letters back from these three pharmacy chains saying, gee, Deborah, we really care about your privacy rights, but no. We will not agree to a consent process. And so that's what, that proof, was what enabled us to have standing in federal court, because the way I understand it, and you know I'm not a lawyer.
Right, of course, yeah.
The way our lawyers explained it to me was, well, you know, how do you have a right?
Right.
If you have to beg someone to exercise it and they can say no.
Right.
basically we got standing in the law in federal court because we were alleging that a fundamental right had been eliminated for the first time in history by a federal agency, not by Congress, but by a federal agency. That was Health and Human Services.
Hmm.
So, we went all the way up through, an appeal en banc at the appellate level. And in each case, we were turned down. And the basis of that was the court said, well, gosh, you know, why are you suing the government? Why don't you sue, you know, private corporations like the pharmacy chains? And, you know, we didn't do this because we believed it really was state action, but they said it wasn't. And so the failure of that lawsuit really was what caused me to jump off a cliff, you know, and in my later life, you know, essentially change primarily into an advocate and to form patient privacy rights, because clearly there was no voice, no organization at the national level speaking for the majority of the American public. And so I, you know, I'm a full-time volunteer, and so I started Patient Privacy Rights in 2004, and actually fairly quickly we were able to build a bipartisan coalition for patient privacy representing 10.3 million people.
Hmm.
And in 2007, at the time, the world's largest technology corporation joined our coalition as well. That was Microsoft at the time. And we worked, the whole point of the organization was to work to restore what we believe are fundamental rights to health information privacy and control of personal information.
We're chatting with Dr. Deb Peel of Patient Privacy Rights on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, Deb, you know, you talk about this experience, and I want to come back to it shortly, your experience advocating on the policy side in Washington.
Yeah.
But before we get there, and this, you know, this is a show, where I like to define terms. The word privacy is itself controversial. And in fact, last week I had on a couple of legal scholars, or last couple of weeks I've had legal scholars on who have challenged the definition of privacy itself. Just so that we know exactly what we're talking about as academic or theoretical questions I'm going to ask you today, how do you define the word privacy? What does privacy mean to you?
Privacy means to me, in healthcare, what it means to virtually everyone, to the entire public. It means the right to control my personal health information. And my understanding is that is actually the legal definition in our field, that it's very well understood that health privacy means the right to control personal information. So in 2006, the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics wrote a letter to the Department of Health and Human Services recommending that they adopt that definition, which is, at least in the area of health, my understanding is that is standard in health.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was Health and Human Services has never adopted that definition. And Congress has never had the ability to to put a definition like that into the law either. So, for example, the stimulus bill, HITECH, that had a lot of new consumer protections for privacy in it. Our champions, our congressional champions, in particular, actually, Congressman Joe Barton, told us, look, Deborah, I'm sorry to tell you this, but, you know, there are not enough votes to restore the consent provisions that were stripped from the HIPAA privacy rule in 2002, and there are not enough votes to add a definition of privacy to federal law. But I'm with you on controlling and stopping the health data mining industry. And, you know, we'll do what we can to build protections into this bill.
And let's talk about that too. Again, this idea of data mining. And before we actually define that, everyone goes to the doctor, and you sign that form that few people read that says, you know, that gives you theoretically what your rights are, in privacy. But again, what we have is a technological shift. And so perhaps, you know, in a couple of minutes, before we get into the data mining issues, about which your organization has pushed hard, what is the state of technology involving personal health records? In other words, when you sign that form, in your typical, if there is one, doctor's office, what happens to your records? Literally, where are they stored, and who has access to them?
Let me just paint a broad picture first.
Sure.
Everyone should assume, because this is true, this is really the truest characterization of the system, that you have no control over electronic health information. You have none. So let's start with the form. It was intended to be a notice of privacy practices, and it was intended that you would be told, according to what state you reside in, how to exercise your rights to control health information according to the laws of your state and federal laws. So as part of our federal lawsuit that we talked about earlier, one of the things we did was we looked at these notices of privacy practices that every healthcare provider is required to give you, and we found that none of them, we never found one that told people how to exercise their rights to control information according to state laws and federal laws. All of them tell you that you have no control, and they cite HIPAA as the authority, as if HIPAA preempts all stronger state, federal, and constitutional protections, tort law protections, common law protections, and so forth. So that was another piece of our lawsuit. You know, we said, you know, essentially, you know, no one is even being told how to exercise their rights. But the point is even the notice of privacy practice tricks people. Doctor's offices don't even understand that people can refuse to sign these notices. They often demand that patients sign them or they won't treat them. But strangely enough, instead of asking people for meaningful informed consent to use their information in certain specific ways, we got a notice. We got notices. So if you sign it, you're only acknowledging that they've told you what they will do with your information. It's not even a consent form, which is confusing to people. So
let me stop you there for a second. Because, you know, I'm not surprised that we're even starting here. So, I would suspect that even the listeners of Hearsay Culture, which runs a range from people that focus on these issues to people that don't focus at all. But I'm guessing that among that group, most people will be surprised to hear that you actually have a right to say no and get treatment.
Yes.
From that doctor. So let me just clarify or put a finer point on that issue by asking the question slightly differently. So if you refuse to sign that form, okay, that notice,
yeah.
Does the doctor have the right to say, fine, I'm not treating you, you have to leave now?
Actually, no, they don't. But it's hopeless to try to educate all these physicians' offices and laboratories and hospitals. X-ray facilities, all the places that you go to.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a notice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, as privacy advocates, we were very concerned that if millions of people started signing these notices, then the government and industry could simply say, well, look, you know, you've acknowledged your privacy's gone. Take a hike.
Right. Right.
You know, we were concerned that the signing of the notices would be an acknowledgement that people are okay with giving up their privacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, and again, and that, and I interrupted you, so I do want to come back to that question of what happens to the records. But, you know, to be clear, what that's suggesting to me, again, is this failure of informed consent. Because I would assume, and I think most people would assume that a doctor's office is not that much different than any other service being offered in the sense that you agree to my terms. You can't discriminate against me on a basis of race or religion, but aside from civil rights types issues, and of course we could talk later about whether this should be a civil right as well, but at this point, the doctor does not have the right to tell you to walk away, whereas I think most consumers would think that the doctor's providing a service like anyone else, and if you don't agree to the doctor's terms, you have to go.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up, because the reason that I am so rabid about this issue is that this is the one place that I know of in American life where we have individual rights to control our information. We have individual rights, and we have a long history of individual rights. We have very strong rights to health information privacy. We have very strong rights to consent, you know, that come from, you know, the Hippocratic Oath influencing American law for over 200 years. So I've lost track of where I was going with this. We, unlike when we open a bank account or buy a cell phone or open an account for credit at a department store, you know, we can't negotiate with banks. You know, we accept their terms or they say take a hike. We can't negotiate as individuals with cell phone companies. You get the point.
Mm-hmm.
In all of these other areas of commerce, we're used to having no rights. But we are not used to having no rights as individuals in healthcare. And the American people know this. They're not all legal scholars, but for example, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, did a study, 20 focus groups across the nation, looking at people's ideas about privacy, and they found that individuals believe as a matter of principle that they should control their information.
And, you know, and it raises that
public,
issue. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. The public understands in health that they should have the right to control sensitive information. The public doesn't believe they have this right in any other area, but there's a deep knowledge of this in healthcare, and I don't think it's because everyone went to law school, obviously, or medical school. It's because we all know that the information is often intensely sensitive and personal. Intensely sensitive and personal. And so that's why these rights were developed in American law. That's why they still exist. And that's why, in fact, HIPAA does not preempt any of these rights. But if you look at the way systems have been developed and engineered, the health technology systems, they've all been developed without any consideration for our longstanding rights to control information. Zero.
We're chatting with Dr. Deborah Peel of patientprivacyrights.org on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation at KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I hope you continue listening. And I should note that last week, I'm recording the show on August 15th. Last week, on the 9th and 10th, I was back at Stanford for a conference of intellectual property law scholars, the IP Scholars Conference, the largest collection of IP geeks that you will find in the U.S. at any one time. time, but I had the opportunity to go back over to KZSU and say hello to some of my friends there. And I will tell you that it is quite an operation that the radio station maintains. Mark Lawrence, who's been the chief engineer, as he told me, for 49 years at KZSU, which blew my mind, is one of the many people who put their time and energy into keeping the station going. So a more personal plea than normal to consider making a donation to KZSU and continue the great programming that it has. Deborah, I interrupted you on the notice issue in answering the question I had asked. I do want to make sure we get to it before we can get into some of the other concerns that you've raised. So let's assume you sign the form and then you get medical treatment. Your doctor's filling out charts and what have you, and then you leave the doctor's office. Again, the traditional format is right. There's three letters on a manila folder that has all of your records in it. Now that information is increasingly going into digital format. So where is that information at that point? Or is it nowhere at that point?
Well, there's a couple of things to say. The latest figures show that even with the stimulus bill, where physicians and hospitals can receive major government subsidies for purchasing electronic health records, that still only about 55% of physicians are adopting them, and that many, many hospitals, I don't know the percentage there, have not adopted electronic health record systems. But the government, and by the way, both parties, Republicans and Democrats, are very, very interested in creating a nationwide system of electronic health records that will be data mined by the government and corporations for a large number of purposes without our consent or control. So both political parties are very interested in building out this major system for, frankly, for surveillance of the most intimate information about us. Like I was saying, physicians are resisting, hospitals are resisting, and just within the last 2 to 3 weeks, Xerox and Harris International polled the public for the third straight year and asked, so, how many of you want electronic medical records? And for the last 3 years, it's been a resounding 27%.
Huh.
That's kind of a, as my kids would say, meh.
Yeah, right.
That's meh. Like, I'm not really particularly interested.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so there's this massive push from government and industry to build this very complex and very intrusive system for collecting and analyzing health information about every American. And it's I don't think that the legal community or the privacy experts in the legal community have really understood what this means, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
We are putting in place the most intrusive, deeply intrusive electronic surveillance system on the planet. That's the plan. That's the plan. And $27 or $29 billion is going into this system with very little appreciation for what this means. So you were asking about what happens in doctors' offices with information. Okay. Mm-hmm. If they have an electronic health record system, and as we're seeing, more and more of them will, and both President Bush and President Obama share the goal that every American will have an electronic health record by 2014. That's a federal goal on both sides. What happens with that information? Well, the first thing that your listeners should know is most of the electronic health record systems data mine and sell your information from the doctor's office. They data mine and sell this information. They use it for purposes that if you knew about, you would never agree to, if you had the right to agree.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as we were saying, because the key privacy protection in the health privacy rule was eliminated in 2002, and people still don't know this. I mean, if you use a word association test, you know, what does HIPAA mean to you? People will say privacy. Well, it only meant privacy. It only meant control over your information for 1 year at the federal level, and then that federal right was eliminated. So the data mining and the loss of control over your information starts in the doctor's office, because most of the vendors of electronic health record systems reserve the right to either own, control, or use whatever information is entered into your chart. So, for example, the poster child we always use for electronic health record systems that violate privacy is a company called Practice Fusion, and their business model is they give the electronic record systems free to physicians' offices, because the premise is that they're going to use and sell the information. Mm-hmm. That's the premise. But they're not the only ones. GE Centricity aggregates and sells information from their electronic health record systems. Cerner does the same. Athena Health also. It's just impossible to know which electronic health record systems use as a business model, as the vendor's business model, selling patient data. So the problems with privacy start the minute that your doctor pulls out a computer. And one of the problems is, for patients, is if you ask your physician, what vendor do you use? What does the contract say? Does it allow the vendor to data mine and own my information, share it? You may get a blank look from the doctor, and you certainly will at the hospital level. Mm-hmm. So when you go into a hospital, your listeners might assume, well, because I know this because I did too, that there's one electronic record system. One. But there's not. Hospitals have between 150 and 800 different contracts with software vendors that move pieces of your electronic health mm-hmm. information. So if you ask the chief technology officer for the hospital, ask someone on the board of the hospital, talk to the chief information officer of the hospital or the hospital system and ask them, well, how many of these health information technology vendors reserve the rights in their contracts to own or use your health data? You know what you're going to get? A blank look. Mm-hmm. Because guess what? That's negotiated by the lawyers. And no one can even tell you at the hospital level where your information is going and who's using it. So we have this incredibly complex system where software technology companies, health information technology companies, are among the largest data miners and users of personal health information. And you might say, well, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Why would they want this information? And the answer is, it turns out it's the most health information, any piece of your health record, is the most valuable commodity in the digital world. It's far more valuable than your social security number. So we understand that social security numbers can be bought and sold on internet websites for about $5 a name. Any piece of your health information is worth $50.
And we're actually we're coming up about 15 minutes left in the interview, and I do want to talk about a few of these issues. Let me push back for a moment. I mean, so if data mining is happening, and so the primary harm here is that your information is sold to third parties without your knowledge, and ultimately you have no clear idea about what they're doing with the information, although you can safely assume that they're using it for marketing purposes and they're trying to figure out obviously products that they can sell, as opposed to providing your information to your employer to use against you in more nefarious way.
Right.
There are, or well, I'll ask you, I mean, there are positive uses of this technology that would benefit consumers, right? I mean, if I'm, you know, I mean, so if my
Absolutely.
Information is put into a, in a digital format, my doctor theoretically sitting, you know, at home one evening could access the records and more quickly perhaps diagnose a problem based upon an x-ray or simply just have more access to a broader range of information more quickly. And assuming that those that there are good reasons for digitizing medical records, is the core of the problem the issue that, in your mind, the issue that consumers simply don't know or have rights to control, or is it a broader question involving the use of the technology itself?
Well, let me answer in a couple of ways. First of all, technology could provide us with exquisite individualized controls over our information. You know, think about Steve Jobs. What was he famous for and why was he so successful? Because he developed products that allowed each person to individualize their experience, you know, like on your little iPod or iTunes. You know, you could select what you wanted. Technology in healthcare could allow exactly that kind of individual decision about what to share, what not to, who should get your information, and under what circumstances. So technology could, in fact, give us far greater, more instantaneous control over health information than anything possible with paper records. So, for example, our vision of the future is we will have one place, an independent URL, where we set our privacy directives. We could set broad directives. We could set very specific directives. And then if a holder of health information or someone who wanted our health information wanted to do anything with it or use it, and our rules didn't cover the situation and let it happen automatically, then we could be pinged on our cell phone and answer right away. So let me just say that technology could be an incredible protector of privacy that would enable people to trust these systems. But we have to have them built in a very different way. And I do understand technology. And my father was an internationally renowned computer scientist before his death. And so I really do get the benefits of technology and the need to, you know, the potential breakthroughs we could get if we were able to collect data and study it. You know, let me just say, so in my field, mm-hmm. in psychiatry, you know, the potential for breakthroughs and important quality and treatment information would be amazing if people were able, if psychiatric patients were able to trust these systems. So, for example, we have no guidance about what antidepressant to use after you've been on two or three. We don't have any. So imagine if people that were being treated for depression trusted these systems and we could look through their records longitudinally and both the patient and I would know, well, gosh, after we've tried these two or three antidepressants, this next one would be a great one to try. I mean, it would be of tremendous value because, you know, today the drug companies are only interested in selling new drugs for the initial treatment of depression. We have no longitudinal information or advice for physicians and patients. So I really get the value of this information. But the problem really isn't, and I'm so glad you asked this, discrimination, which I first told you about, which is a reason I got interested in privacy, is very, very important reason for health information to stay tightly between you and the doctors that treat you or the researchers that you trust. But there's another reason that's even more important than protecting us against discrimination. And that is the fact that when people know their information isn't private, millions per year, millions, and this is from HHS studies back in 2000, millions per year refuse early diagnosis and treatment for cancer, because they know that information doesn't stay private. Major depression, same reason, because they know that information does not stay private. And sexually transmitted diseases. So for me, this is actually the most important reason that we have to fix these systems, because if electronic systems destroy privacy, people learn this. People know this. They know this already. They knew this in the paper age, and it's clear that in the electronic age, the ability to control this information has been erased. When people know that they can't keep sensitive information private, they will take risks with their own lives. They'll take risks with their own lives. Delaying early diagnosis and treatment for cancer, for depression, and for sexually transmitted diseases, puts you at risk. Puts you at risk for really bad outcomes.
Or, as you've pointed out, perhaps equally of concern, as you point out in the white paper that's on your website, patientprivacyrights.org, as you wrote, a black market for totally private treatment will develop for those who can pay to protect themselves and their families from discrimination and reputational harm, as you pointed out in your first initial experience in your first week of practicing medicine, with people willing to pay you cash. There are harms here on all sides, and I guess in the remaining 7 or so minutes that we have, I do want to ask you, because you are inside the Beltway attempting to influence policy here, from the broadest standpoint, what's been your experience talking about these issues on Capitol Hill? What kind of reactions do you generally get, recognizing that this is an issue that, as you pointed out, has bipartisan support?
Mm-hmm. Well, the public, in huge majorities, 90% and above, in polling over at least 20 years, believes that we should have the ability to control sensitive health information. This is something that the American public is completely united about, from the far left to the far right, libertarians, communists, socialists, progressives, wing nuts, everyone in this country wants to control this sensitive information. And so it's interesting. This is truly a bipartisan issue, and we were able to put together, I think I was talking about our coalition earlier, an amazing bipartisan coalition. One of the members is the ACLU. Another member is the American Conservative Union. We have the Gun Owners of America, and we have Microsoft. In fact, when Microsoft Corporation joined the coalition in 2007, they were the largest technology company in the world, and it made a huge impression. It made a huge impression to have them on the side of consumers and patients saying, hey, we really ought to build this electronic health system in a way that honors and respects patients' rights to be asked before their information is used. So the public, the point of patient privacy rights is to wake up and inform and educate the public. And that's been really hard. What we face in Washington, however, is that the health data mining industry and the use of information without consent, the lawyers and the lobbyists for all the corporations that want to use and sell our information absolutely overwhelm the few privacy heroes in Congress. And in fact, at the second International Summit on the Future of Health Privacy, we honored the two House champions for privacy that formed the House Privacy Caucus, I think 10 to 15 years ago, and that's Representative Joe Barton from Texas and Representative Ed Markey from Massachusetts. And I would have to say that I think my biggest disappointment in going to Washington repeatedly has been that despite this issue uniting the entire public, we still have the same very few numbers of privacy champions in Congress that we had when patient privacy rights first started going to Washington in 2005 or 2006, because unfortunately, health information is, as I was saying earlier, an incredibly valuable commodity, and no one wants to ask us for our permission to use our information. They want to just use it.
We're chatting with Professor, I keep saying Professor, Doctor. But you do have an academic sound, which I, by the way, to be clear, I consider a compliment, in discussing these issues. Dr. Deborah Peel, patientsprivacyrights.org. So Deborah, in a remaining couple of minutes that we have, and specifically, so, when you discuss these issues, on Capitol Hill, are you finding that there is sympathy among elected officials to do something about these issues? Because you are coming at this from the perspective of a consumer advocate, although what you're saying, it sounds very reasonable, to me. In 2 minutes or so, do you have any, particular insights as far as, the average consumer in supporting the work that you do vis-a-vis, influencing, elected officials, to deal with the policy and legal implications of the issues you raise?
We urge everyone, and I hope everyone that listens to this, to tell or write your members of Congress and say, look, I want you to fix this mess in healthcare. I want you to put me back in control of my information. It is not acceptable to me that my information is used in hidden and secret ways, for research or for profit, ways that can harm me and my family. That is not acceptable. And actually, this brings me to a project that Patient Privacy Rights is working on with the Harvard Data Privacy Lab. Mm-hmm. That is, the public is being asked to weigh the risks versus the benefits of technology, right? And there's plenty of industry and government propaganda urging people to use electronic health systems. But it's unfair and unwise to use these systems when you have no idea where health data flows. So Patient Privacy Rights and Harvard have a research project that we're hoping to begin within the next few months called the datamap.org. And the point of this is to ask people inside healthcare or outside to help us fill in the map of where health data flows, because our estimate is that health data flows to hundreds, possibly thousands of organizations inside and outside the U.S. that we don't even know about. We want to map the hidden data flows, because how can we fix the problem of what's going on with health information if we don't even know where the information goes? Not only that, how can any of us figure out if health information has been used to deny us a job or credit if there's no chain of custody? We don't have a chain of custody for who touches our health information, much less the ability to say yes or no at each point of data transfer. So the healthdatamap.org is an important project. I hope that your listeners will we'll look into, and in fact, at our website, www.healthprivacysummit.org, you can look at the 2012 Summit for Health Privacy, and the drop down menu will list the data map, and LaTanya Sweeney, you can see a video of her explaining this. But we really have to know where our health data flows before we can make any kind of decision about whether it's worth the risk of being participating in electronic records or not. And so I would also urge your listeners to say no to health information exchange. Say no to health information exchange at the state level, and work for that to prevent your data from flowing to endless third parties that, again, you won't even know about. You won't even know about. If you need to exchange your information, you ought to be able to do so. You should be able to electronically consent for information to flow. And there's a brand new study in the Journal of the American Medical Informatics Association by researchers at Wake Forest who found, surprisingly, that when patients are given the ability to provide electronic consent for their x-rays to be shipped from one place to another, this research was done at Wake Forest. They trust the systems, the data gets to the right place, and there's no need for complex legal agreements between hospitals and doctors and the rest to use information without consent. That actually consent from the patients electronically is the cheapest, best, and most trustworthy way for our information to flow. And that article, which was just announced within the last week or two, that's the first instance I know of where electronic consent is being used to let people control where their data flows.
And on that positive note, Dr. Deborah Peel of patientprivacyrights.org, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. These are critically important issues. I look forward to having you back on the show as this issue progresses, because obviously there's still a lot of work to be done. But thank you for joining us on the show and bringing this issue to the attention of my listeners.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
I'm excited to mention a few guests coming up as this quarter winds to a close. I have will be posting, it's already on iTunes, but I'll be posting on hearsayculture.com certainly by the time that this show airs next week. It's being recorded on August 15th, several shows that were aired this quarter. And coming up for the remaining dates in this quarter, Professor Madhavi Sundar of UC Davis School of Law, author of From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice, Marcin de Kaminski and Stefan Larsson of Lund University on Pirate Bay, Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia Law, co-author of The Knockoff Economy. As always, you can listen to the show on KZSU live Tuesdays, 9 a.m. Pacific time, or you can get the show by going to Apple iTunes and finding the Center for Internet Society's page in iTunes, or by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is the Center for Internet Society's webpage, or by going to hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining today on Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more great programming, and have a great day.